Welcome to our Open Research Podcast. We invite you to join us in our audio space here at Sheffield Hallam University to dive into more in-depth discussions around open research. I'm Domi Smithson from the Library Research Support Team. Let's jump to the next topic we have for you, which is the AI in research. And for that, I've invited Dr. Keith Files, our Research Development Manager for Policy and Performance. You may know Keith from our previous episodes on open research, where we've discussed the purpose of open practice, research metrics, and REF. Hello, Keith.
Hi, Domi. Thanks for inviting me back.
We are in a transition stage in the academic environment. We are adjusting policies, updating policies, or putting new policies in place to address artificial intelligence. We also think about new ways of supporting researchers. So it's about supporting staff and students in using AI effectively, but also ethically and transparently, which fits into the model around open research practices. As a research support librarian, I was looking for new ways on how to support researchers who wish to use generative AI in their research, where we organize those different aspects around specific stages of the research project. We've listed three main stages of the research cycle. We would start with the planning stage, go through the active stage, and then finally reach the dissemination stage. Three main questions around that would be, firstly, if you even should use AI in your research. Then the second one would be to address how should we use AI. And then lastly, upon dissemination of your research, you should know how should you communicate the use of AI. So starting with the planning stage, as I mentioned before, you should check if you're even permitted to use generative AI in your research. So when you're drafting your research project, you should check your funders and third-party requirements before you involve AI tools in the project. That's a must. There might be certain requirements around AI, so it's worth checking all those agreements first.
That's one of the considerations. I think with all research planning, you've got to think down and sort of, what's my research question? What do I want to achieve? And what's the best method to do that? So you can review a list of methods, and using AI is just a different method that you can consider. The funder policies tend to be more around things around involvement in authorship and things like that. I'm not sure I've seen too much sort of specified in kind of brief sort of use of it as a method. But I think any researcher, you have to justify what method you're going to use and why you think that the best for the particular challenge you're tackling.
Could you tell us more about our Hallam policies?
It's really interesting. So it's been such a rapidly evolving situation, sort of especially sort of about 18 months ago, sort of it just sort of exploded. And everyone was like, oh, hang on, what are we supposed to be doing here? So we tried to write a policy to capture that. And the first thing we had to say was, we can only work on the level of principles. The systems were all moving so quickly, so many different systems appearing, doing different things. So we just said, actually, let's just stick on the level of principles. These are the fundamentals you should be doing, you shouldn't be doing. These are the opportunities, these are the threats. And then actually leave the specific systems in. So yeah, we published a policy. I think we sort of finished it around November 23. I think it came on the website December 23.
So it's 1 year old now.
Yeah. It's called AI in Research Integrity, and it's found on the SHU Ethics website, which the ethics website's on the external site, and then there's a guidance section, and it's one of the guidance.
I'm happy to link that out as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. You were speaking earlier about the checklist. The checklist is the thing to make it sort of more practicable for researchers to go through and understand what they're doing. But actually, they both work on the same levels in terms of the planning, sort of thinking about why AI, is this the right thing for me? What are the limitations? What are the consequences? What are the mitigations? That type of thing. There's some sort of real kind of threats and opportunities as well. So there's opportunities. So it could be something that can really sort of fast forward your research. It can do some of the quite mundane stuff that it could take you weeks and weeks to do. It could run and process in a couple of seconds. So there's real opportunities to fast forward your research, but there's real threats. And a couple of things we've tried to pick up in the policy are the things that you absolutely shouldn't do. And there's really kind of core ones of those. The first one of those is around uploading your data. This is the one that we're most sort of concerned that people will do. There's different types of AI, and fundamentally the difference is between open AI and private AI. Open AI means a system where you upload your data to, and the system keeps that data. It retains it for its training data. It makes it available to other users. And then there's private AI, which you can have all the same processing power, but the system doesn't keep your data. So you're just using it, but your data stays within your institution, within your computer or whatever. So that's the big difference. And the thing that we really don't want researchers doing is uploading their research data to open AI systems, because then you're making it available to all third parties. So the software companies, other users. So there's problems with that, especially if it's human personal,
sensitive human personal data.
So anything with names in qualitative data, you're just kind of losing control of that. As soon as you upload, other people can do it, and it's actually breaking GDPR law as well as being a research.
But if the researcher is working with anonymized data, they can still use public AI tools.
Yeah, but it has to be properly anonymized. Mm-hmm. So that's in the sense that the keys have been destroyed that could potentially identify things. So we'd usually say, if you're going to use it for processing data, use a private AI system. Mm-hmm. But once you've processed the data, you've fully anonymized it, destroyed the key. So when you're putting it like on the data repository, that sort of stage, then that's fine. That can kind of go anywhere. But yeah, while it's still kind of live working data, while there's still identifiers in there, we'd really suggest don't put it on an open AI system. Make sure it's a private one with a licensing arrangement.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned in that questionnaire as well to think about the level of transparency of your chosen AI tool, but also about the ethical principles of research integrity.
Yeah, a lot of ethics always works on the same principles. So it's things like transparency, informed consent, confidentiality around personal data, effective sharing, accurate acknowledgement, all those kind of things are the same, and they apply whether you're using AI or not.
Mm-hmm. And what are the risks around copyright issues?
There's probably two things here. So the first is, if you upload your data to an open system, mm-hmm. other people have access to it. So if you've not kind of secured your intellectual property over it, as you usually would where you publish it, in theory, other people have access to that data before you've used it. You could have sort of like new data on sort of new experiments you'll be doing, and that could be available to other researchers, other companies around the world. So you've got to be careful about putting your data up there. Mm-hmm. There's also a thing sort of much later in the process in terms of publications. So when you publish open access and that's supposed to be available to everyone, when other people use it, they credit you in references and things like that. AI doesn't do that. So mm-hmm. there's a potential threat that AI could reuse your publications and even reuse them for commercial purposes, and you're not getting any credit or remuneration for that. So that's one thing. We haven't seen much of it happening, but it does happen in other areas. Sort of, there's quite a lot of talk in things like music around the use of music and training data, and it's the same for publications. If your publications are out in the world, an AI system could use them, turn out something. So it could be, so you've written a research article on a topic, and someone types in, oh, I want to write a textbook on this thing. AI would generate something which would be based heavily on your research, but it would never credit or acknowledge you. So it's just being sort of wary of things like that happening, especially mm-hmm. sort of if it's coming to market and someone else is making profit out of that.
Which brings us back to the planning stage, where we also linked out the government web pages on copyright and related things around artificial intelligence. And the next item on our checklist is the PIA document. So this document requires you to acknowledge the use of AI tools. So you're actually obligated to declare you're planning on using AI. Also, if your research involves human participants, you should disclose the use of AI tools in your information sheets and consent forms to ensure that an informed consent is gained to allow for the sharing of the anonymized data with AI system. After your application has been approved, you're moving to the active stage of your project and you start working with data. I would like to talk a bit more about input and output data and some of the risks associated with those, like bias. But first things first, Keith, would you be able to explain what generative AI is?
So generative AI is where it uses historic data and all this machine learning and an algorithm to turn out outputs. Mm-hmm. So you're actually getting it to create something new. It could come in lots of forms. It could be text or code or images or music or videos. So it's producing sort of something new from it. You were talking about biases. So one thing you have to understand is that it is just input data and an algorithm. And depending on the quality of that input data and understanding what the algorithm is as well, is how useful the outputs are. We talk about biases. It could be all kinds of things. So if you're going to use, say, the internet as a source of data, we know there's bad things in the internet that it doesn't necessarily represent the best of human values. So you might use internet data and it comes out and your outputs end up being racist and misogynistic because that's the sum of the internet, unfortunately, happens. Mm-hmm. We just encourage researchers to understand as much as possible what the input data is, but then also what the algorithm's doing, it sort of why it's coming out with these decisions and predictions. So it's not just a black box. Okay, it's processing it in this ways, and I understand why it's doing that, so I understand why the outputs are valid.
So how can researchers evaluate the AI outputs for any possible biases?
They've really just got to try and actually get into not the code, because that's a bit technical, but actually just try and understand what the program around it's doing, so it isn't just here's my question, give me an answer. Just don't accept stuff if you don't really understand what's going on behind it. That applies for things outside of AI as well.
We want researchers to know how they formulate their questions, not only because it affects the quality of the output data, but the wording of the question itself becomes input data that you feed the AI tool with. So that becomes the training data for AI as well. Even if you're only using AI to generate ideas, a question which uses outdated or biased terms will lead to outdated and biased outputs. Researchers should really consider the quality of their research prompts. We also need to remember that generative AI is a tool of statistical nature, can be inaccurate and biased depending on the training data it's based on. We listed some examples of the limitations around AI, like just mentioned the predictive statistics, which limits the capacity to generate new data and constrains creativity. When learning about AI, you will also hear about hallucinations and deepfakes, which takes us back to the question around AI outputs and if they're really reliable. Can you think of any examples, Keith?
When you're writing, and this is something I think in universities we come across more in sort of student assignments rather than sort of staff research, but AI has a couple of habits. So first of all, it doesn't check references. So if it's read something and that other thing has references in it, it predicts what's in those other references. It doesn't go and check them. So that's where these kind of hallucinations come from. It talks about something that a certain text says, which the text never actually says. It does other things like this. It creates references to work that doesn't exist at all, sort of fake references. So there's a lot of danger in its summarizing that it isn't summarizing accurately. So it's fine sometimes to ask it to summarize stuff, but then you've really got to get into it and check that it's accurate. And this is one thing we often find, that in most cases it's more efficient not to use it for it. You might as well just go and read the original and the references rather than trying to get this, just because the accuracy isn't good enough yet.
Mm-hmm. You said that reproducibility is always central to research integrity. What about the reproducibility crisis and the AI being a black box? How we can replicate research when we involve AI?
Yeah, that's why researchers really kind of need to understand what these black boxes are doing, so they can document their process. And there's no sort of right way to do this. It's just about being as open as possible. So I had this query, I ran it in this thing, this came out, these were the bits I rejected, these are the bits I accepted. Just being quite transparent about that. Mm-hmm. So in theory, someone else can do the same thing. And it won't always come out the same, because the training data is presumably expanding and evolving. So if someone else did the same thing, it might not do, but you can at least document your process. This is what I did at this time, and these were the decisions I made.
It aligns with the principle of open research, where we want to be as open, as transparent as possible. But it's not only about the research outcome, it's also about the process of how we came up with the following conclusions. Being transparent helps us to verify research, but how we can ensure that the information produced by AI is verifiable? There are certain ways to demonstrate the rigor in your work. You can check for the acceptable error rate. We do recommend to avoid using tools that rely on a lower quality information. And keep records of your work in progress. That will enable the reproducibility. We've also listed following recommendations, which should be added to the methodology section of your research. Firstly, it's about listing the prompts that you use to generate the response in AI system, which is called the prompt engineering history, essential for evaluation purposes. And secondly, you should provide the date each output was generated. Another idea is to share all the outputs as an appendix, and you should briefly explain the changes you made to the initial outputs, so-called a track changes document or a descriptive paragraph that you can attach. And then finally, we reach the dissemination stage, where researchers should communicate the use of AI. It's not only about documenting the choice of AI tool, but also how it was used and the data that was input. You also need to know how to reference AI. That comprehensive reference should include not only AI name, but also URL and the day accessed. What we've highlighted in the checklist is the reminder that AI should never be acknowledged as a co-author. And now while we know a bit more about AI, could you tell us what do you think is the synergy between AI and open research?
It's really interesting. In some ways, they should be really harmonious, but in other ways, they actually really conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this is to do with what AI is coming from and who it's being used for. So there's two different ways you can think about this. So a lot of AI is being driven at the moment for profit, and it's very much, can we replace human action for efficiencies by doing this? So that sort of drive for profit comes with closeness and not paying for things and sort of taking out the human labor. So that's why a lot of the risks to this come, that people might steal your data, use it for other purpose, not pay you, not credit it for it. So there is that sort of negativity that actually this is a closed thing, and also not making the algorithms and the input data available for scrutiny. Again, it's tying in that kind of commercial model. So that's one thing where it's bad and we need to be guarded against. But AI can also be brilliant and has real opportunities. So there's one project I'm quite interested in. This is just about the Herculaneum papyri project. A couple hundred years ago, they found, sort of, when they were digging at Herculaneum, all these old kind of charred scrolls, and they just look like burnt sausages. They're not very useful for anything. Like, Napoleon used to give them out as presents to people just as a curiosity. But they've actually found the way, through using really sort of high-powered CT scanners, that they can scan them, and then they can use AI to identify the markers of ink in them and sort of digitally unroll them, because they're obviously scrolls, so there's layer over layer that has been sort of burnt and compressed together. And they're slowly finding ways, because when people have tried to open them, they've just crumbled to dust, but they're finding ways to be able to read them. And I think last year they read the first sort of bit of text, and I think by the end of this year they're hoping to read whole scrolls. And there's 1,500 of these, which actually represents more ancient literature than already exists. So we might double the volume of ancient literature that exists, sort of, mm-hmm. like find lots of exciting sort of, I don't know, Greek poetry and Roman history and lots of interesting stuff. This project, so one, it's using AI to do this, but it's all being done in a very open sense. So every development that happens in this area, people have to share their code, their work. It's just encouraging really kind of open international collaborations. It's like, oh, I've done a bit to help with the ink, make that available. Oh, I've done a bit with unrolling and sort of reads like that. And it's just a really exciting example of a collaborative project that's using AI, it's using open research, and it's doing something for the good of humanity to try and sort of
to discover the knowledge buried in ashes.
Absolutely. So I think that's just a really nice example of how AI and open research can work together.
Definitely. Okay. Thank you very much for today, Keith.
Yeah, thanks, Naomi.
You have now reached the end of another episode of our Open Research Podcast. We are shortly releasing episodes on transdisciplinary working, so please stay tuned and follow us on Spotify.